Thank you very much, Doug. The only trouble with introductions like that is they are really rather like fairy tales, and then you get me. I love W.H. Auden's definition of a professor. A professor is someone who speaks in someone else's sleep. So if you had a hard night, feel free. I enjoy giving this talk now, although I did not set out to give this talk in the first instance with any pleasure whatsoever, really. Most of the things that have happened in my life to get me out of my ivory tower have been the work of either my wife or students. Both groups seem to have been dedicated to disturbing my comforts. Ideally, I would have lived in my ivory tower all my life. The only thing I was fit to be was an academic. I don't have enough responsibility to really take care of patients every day because I'll go to the library and forget what I should have been doing. But fortunately, I have a wife who is very well organized, and I just ask her where I'm going to speak next. And she tells me a month beforehand so that I get the right tickets. And the students also picked up that this rather curmudgeonly professor who for many years would walk in and give a lecture, making it fairly clear that he didn't actually care whether they understood it or not, and walk out afterwards without allowing time for questions. Because I knew that as long as I had research grants and was publishing, the dean wouldn't care what else I did. And it's a lovely life. I had a friend in the philosophy department who shared the same view. We used to commiserate with one another on a weekly two-hour shameless lunch. How much better the university would be if only we could get rid of the students. But he would say every September, here we go again, teaching the herd of independent minds how to read. But good things come to an end, but if you're in the kingdom, when God disturbs you, there's always a good reason for it. And I was sucked out of that academic ivory tower by a conjunction of wife, students, and one other man who was another Brit who I met in a cocktail party, of all places. What he was doing there was fishing, I'm sure, and I was the fish. But he had left Oxford and worked for InterVarsity Christian Fellowship continuously thereafter. And I was talking to him and said, well, the only problem is, I'm an evangelical, I believe the gospel is true, but I also know that the evangelical church is no good training for a student going to university. They face about an 80% probability that their faith will not survive the interaction with the university. They may go to church, but it won't show up during the week. The best you can hope for in most cases is a schizophrenic Christian. The wiser ones, the more honest ones, actually give it up completely, at least for a while. If you ask a physician how long it was since they entered medical school, what was the longest period that they went without any subjective feeding by prayer or reading the scriptures? The answer is measured in years. And if it's an academic, you can put that in double digits. In my own case, 20 years. Which is why I run the college I run now, to try and short-circuit that program. Now, we can do that. We know how to do it. But that's another lecture. But this all came out of the students who picked up, even in lectures on biochemistry, that I didn't think the university had got it all right. And then one of them had the courage. They actually heard me via this other man I told you about, who, amazingly, after that cocktail conversation, called me a few months later and said, will you do my annual banquet address for fundraising for IVCF in Ottawa? And I said, after what I told you about the outcome, you still want me to talk? And he said, yes, they need to hear that, but try and be a little less cynical if you know how to be. He was honest. I doubt that I was. But in the audience was a young man who had just got into medical school, our medical school. So come September, he rather timorously knocks on my door and says, are you actually a Christian? And I said, well, yes, I am, if you mean by that Do I believe that the gospel is true and that we therefore owe obedience to Christ? Yes, I am a Christian. I'm not very good at it. And he said, will you help us? There are four of us in first year who want to hold on to our faith. Will you help us? I was about to say no, when my mother appeared at the back of my head and said, you could do that. You ought to do that. So instead of no, I said, what do you want me to do? And he said, well, would you do some Bible studies with us to help us to integrate faith and practice? And I thought, I said, all right, I'll do 4 weeks. You better come to my house at 8:30 on Wednesday evening so that you've done some study beforehand and you're not neurotic, and we'll see where we go. I didn't do 4 weeks. I did 10 years.
Awesome.
And, of course, I got to love those students because they love me. And then they wreck your lives, because once you start to like them, you have to respond. And after a while, they persuaded me to start doing some conferences. And one thing led to another. And nowadays, I give about 400 lectures a year and go around the world once. The day before yesterday, the wonderful experience of teaching about 2,000, mainly students, at the largest medical missions conference in the world, which happens in Kentucky every year. A wonderful, encouraging experience. You can live on the young. They've got naive optimism. I have to teach them to be a bit more subtle, which is what I'm going to do now. Now, as this developed, my wife said, being a very efficient woman, you answer the same question too often on emails. I'm going to start a website. I said, that's a total waste of time, but you'll do it anyway, which she proceeded to do, and she was right, I was wrong. About 30,000 people a year go to that website now. I had no idea the power of the internet. I'm beginning to realize, and beginning to realize I have to decide how to use that power. But, and that's with no advertising at all. The college is up around 75,000 now. We can win this battle.
Yes.
So the students, who are all media savvy, watch where I go and turn up at lectures. So on Thursday evening, one of our graduates from Augustine had driven 3 hours to get to the lecture, basically to have coffee with me. That's deeply moving. And so a few years ago, the students in Detroit saw that I was going to Ann Arbor in Michigan. They're smart. They knew I lived in Ottawa. I had to go through Detroit or Windsor to get there, and they called and said, will you talk to us first? And I said, well, sure. What do you want me to do? And they said, the date will be January the 23rd, which is the Roe v. Wade decision in the U.S. We want you to talk about abortion in the university medical school in the middle of the day. And I said, I don't do that. I talked about most things, but up to that point, not about abortion. Although I was guilty, and I knew it. And they said, but we've heard you speak. We think you could do it. Why don't you do it? And I said, I don't wish to be lynched in public. And they said, we don't think you will be. You're good at it. I said, very kind of you to say that, but I'm still not one whit more willing to do it. And then they did the Christian thing and said, we've been praying about it. And it turned out they had. And I knew that this was going to happen. And with the help of Robert Spitzer, who I considered to be the best apologist for the Christian faith on the continent, I had some ideas about how to go about it somewhat differently. So I gave the lecture. And to my astonishment, it ended in dead silence. Not a single aggressive question. It did start medical students for choice in the University of Detroit, in Wayne State University. But it also got the pro-life students going. And that has happened every time since. I've given that lecture in Harvard, in California, in Minnesota, you name it, all over, at least 50 or 60 times now. And every time it ends in dead silence. And on several occasions, Planned Parenthood have called an emergency meeting afterwards. So what I want to try and do in the next 40 minutes or so is to explain to you how the pro-life community could become a bit more sophisticated and engage the opposition in a way that forces them to at least engage properly with what's at stake. Now, the way I routinely do it, and you can do this in any medical school, is to begin with a question they don't expect. And the key to the whole thing is you must develop the habit of never making statements and always asking questions. Every medical student should have that on their fridge. So they set out to school every morning. The last thing they think about before they leave home is, how do I ask the right questions today? The greatest questioners in history, of course, were first Jesus and second Socrates. They're the people to study. And if you can get a question that has both got a little touch of ironic humour and comes in as a surprise, it's the perfect start for a lecture of this sort. So routinely, I begin in the same way. And I can say this to any medical school anywhere in the world. Usually, most of the students in the lecture will be from preclinical. There will be some from clinical years, but they'll be primarily preclinical. And I say, I want to talk first to those in their first and second years of medical school. If I was to say to you that within 6 weeks of beginning medical school, you decided there were some people in your class to whom you would never trust the care of a dog of yours, what would you say? And of course, just as here you see a few ironic smiles in the medical school, they're all around the lecture room. The answer is yes. The next question that follows it is, if we took a consensus vote in your class about who those people are, would there be agreement? And the answer is yes again. The students know within 6 weeks that at least 20% of the class do not have the essential characteristics that are required of a physician. They are not trustworthy. The faculty never have a clue because, of course, the so-called evaluators of education have been got at by the indoctrinment. And the things that are at stake are qualities, not quantities. They cannot be measured, therefore they say they are not real, which is rubbish. The class knows. Those people will lose their license 3, 4, 5 years after graduation. Nobody in their class will be surprised. But there will be no evidence on their university record that this was going to happen. Not because it couldn't have been known, but because even within the church, a pattern of thought is a post-indoctrinment one, and we need to deal with that. But that, again, is another hour's lecture. So by this point, I have their attention. And I say, well, we're going to talk about abortion today, but not quite in the way you expect. First thing I want to say to you is that whatever else abortion is, it is essentially a moral question. The question is, what, if any, duties do we owe to human beings before they are born? What, if any, duties do we owe to human beings before they are born? Now, that immediately sets some thinking. And I say, what I want to point out to you is something that you haven't thought about, because I know the word bigot goes around this medical school. Is there any possibility of agreement in this medical school about a woman's right to choice? And of course the answer is no. Absolutely no possibility of agreement. It divides you in two groups, with a large middle group that don't know what they think and don't care, including that 20%. But let's leave the amoral group out of it. Because apart from issues of life and sexuality, do you trust one another to practice reasonably ethical medicine? And the answer still is yes, fortunately. As long as you exclude this area of moral activity that's concerned with matters of life and death and sexuality. So I say, and presumably both groups consider themselves to be coherent. So surely our first question turns out then not to be about abortion at all. There's a preceding question that we need to deal with first. And the preceding question is this. What would you need to believe in order to be an ethical, coherent abortionist? And what would you need to believe in order to be an ethical, coherent anti-abortionist? That's the real question. So let's deal with that first. Now, in Canada, it's fairly easy to unpack this with the example of Henry Morgenthaler. I don't know how much you know about Henry Morgenthaler. I hope you pray for him regularly, as I try to whenever I have the mercy and charity to do so. But I hope you know that Henry Morgenthaler lost all his family except one brother in Auschwitz. If that had happened to you, do you think you might have been embittered? I think I might have been. It would have taken great grace to get me where I am now. After that experience, his brother who kept him alive, I gather, is still an Orthodox Jew and wishes on occasion that he hadn't kept Henry alive. But Henry became an existentialist, which is the solution to the problem. He came to believe that life is absurd. It has no meaning, as a lot of people do, if they haven't been properly formed. The world is not a charitable place. There's an awful lot of pain and suffering out there. And you have to deal with these issues, but we don't do it in church very much. I went from a good Bible-believing church to medical school. I had never heard a serious sermon on poverty, on justice, and on death that would help me in medical school. From a good Bible, I knew the Bible, thank God. That was the gift my parents gave me. But not integrating it into those circumstances. So Henry comes to believe that life has no ultimate meaning, but he's still Jewish. He inhabits the Jewish story of compassion for those who are suffering. Now, a woman who is pregnant when she doesn't want to be, is she suffering? She is, isn't she? Her life is about to be disrupted big time, whatever she does. She has three options, none of which is attractive. She can have an abortion, which terminates the pregnancy, but she ought to be told she'll never forget the date and she will not forget the event. She will have to live with it. She can give the baby up for adoption, but in that case she will be wondering for the rest of her life what's happening to it. Or she can keep the baby, which in most cases will lead to economic marginalization, the loss of a career, and the loss of a decent life in many respects. Those are three ways of losing. Henry has come to believe that the world has no meaning, therefore says his ethics are going to be necessarily utilitarian ethics. Utilitarian ethics of net happiness. I know it's a rather horrible concept of sort of having two tubs of happiness and taking the one with the most happiness in it, but that's roughly what it is. And for him, the cleanest solution, the ethical one, is the abortion. Because what he sees when this woman comes to him is two human lives. At his best, not always on television, but on his best, one-on-one, he will always admit that what he does is snuff out human life. He doesn't pretend. As all the leading feminists don't pretend either. It's only the lower ranks that still pretend that it isn't that. Don't think that you'll find a leading feminist who will be caught on this one. They won't. They'll say, yes, we snuff out human life, but it's necessary. Because, of course, the child, let's put it in your case, when you are asleep and unself-conscious, are you happy or unhappy? The answer, of course, is neither. So, when you are in utero and you haven't yet become self-conscious, you are neither happy nor unhappy. So your death in utero makes no difference to the net happiness in the world. The absurdity of that life is the same as the absurdity of the woman who's alive. But what has happened to the net happiness when the baby's gone? Well, it's increased. So you can be an ethical, coherent abortionist if, and I think only if, you believe that life has no meaning. But that has consequences. And we'll come to those in a moment. Now put Mother Teresa by the bed. She has a different premise. This is not a religious argument. This is an argument about the nature of moral rationality. We are all oughted. It's a condition of being human, as Wittgenstein put it. Ethics is a condition of man. Now, Henry's got his sorted out, and it leads to abortion. Mother Teresa, on the other hand, sees two eternally significant lives, one of whom is about to put her soul in jeopardy. What is not the religious, but the rational thing to do now if you're a ordinary, decent human being? It's the exact opposite. Everything you can to avoid that woman destroying her own soul. So the discussion between the two groups is not to be divided up as rational and irrational, which is what the liberals would like. They want to claim that they have a corner on rationality. They don't. Mother Teresa is just as rational as Henry Morgenthaler, but she accepts a different starting premise. I love it when, on the lecture circuit, I run into somebody who knew me before I came out of my ivory tower. And nowadays, lectures always seem to have photographs on them, and I haven't aged that rapidly, so they look at the photograph and see my name and turn up at the lecture in some university or other and say, I haven't seen you for years. And I say, no, neither are you, but I stopped going to the sort of meetings where we met. They said, yes, I noticed. I used to read your stuff until the early 90s. The clear implication, which academics are never frightened to say, you lost your mind in the early 90s. And so I say, so you're accusing me of losing it? And they say, well, more or less. And I say, well, I can show that that is not true. What do you call somebody who truly loses their mind? And of course the answer is irrational, mad, crazy. What happens to their life? Well, it falls apart. What happened to me in the early 90s is that I started to take a faith that was in hibernation seriously. My life didn't so much fall apart as fall together. It didn't get worse, it got better. Not as dramatically as I would wish. I only have to ask my wife and she points out there's a long way to go. But there is real progress. So my faith is not irrational, as you would like to believe. It is supra-rational. Your problem is that you confuse a post-endarkment rationality with being a total description. It's not. It's a subset. It's a very good, a very useful subset. A reductionistic approach to nature is, in my view, the right way to do science. I did science to see how much of God's world I could understand without invoking God. And I think I can justify that in God's presence. I think that's what he intended me to do. God doesn't show up in my science. It shows up in my mind and the way I appreciate that science, but not the way that I do it. The way to deal with Dawkins and all the rest is to say science is methodological, and you're making it ideological. If the methods section of a paper is correct, you have no choice but to print the results. That's the only ethical outcome. Now, you can disagree about the discussion, but that should be done by correspondence and with civility, not by ideological warfare, which is what Dawkins is inducing at the moment. So, that's the two worlds. And I can say to the students, if you followed my argument thus far, the word bigotry ought to be removed from this medical school, because the bigot is someone who will not conceive seriously that the alternative to their own starting proposition might be true. That's all we have to do to get a little civility. But do we have to stop there? No, of course we don't. There's much more we can do. We ought to look at what modern medicine calls outcomes analysis, and so do many other parts of the world. And this is where it's important to use Thomas Aquinas' approach, that whenever you are going to ultimately espouse a final position, start with all charity making your opponent's position better than he can. So you must know the best pro-choice arguments and point out their strengths. The good news is that when you do that, they relax. And of course, the first one is that as long as I conceived that this issue, as long as I felt that it was a woman's issue, then clearly abortion was going to be all right. It was her choice. And I held that position for 20 years. I got sucked into that position through rubella babies in the 1960s. Actually started medical school 50 years ago this year. So I was doing infectious diseases in London in the 1960s. And every now and again, I would see a woman with a rash who was pregnant. And she would ask, is this rubella? We didn't have a vaccine at that point. And I'd say, well, looks like it. We'll take some blood today, some more blood in 10 days' time. I'll see you 2 days later, and we'll know. Because then I would have objective data which would demonstrate whether or not she had an active rubella infection. If she did, then I had to look at the dates and work out when she got the disease. I could do all that and then give her the prognosis, which was anything up to 90% probability of having a baby with major cardiac and or neurological difficulties. I never used the word abortion. I had already separated my faith and my practice because the church had not taught me how to keep them together. And medicine was about solving problems. And having a baby with those kinds of difficulties is a problem. And so what I said was, would you like to start again? What would any woman say? Yes. We never mentioned the word abortion. It was strictly illegal. I said, well, we can do that. We can allow you to start again. That's all the discussion that was necessary. And then she would have a DNC on an ordinary gynae operations list. It was illegal, but nothing would happen, and I knew nothing would happen, and I felt no guilt, because she'd got what she wanted. And she felt better, initially at least. I didn't follow up to know what happened in the longer term, and it took me a long while. Even when the guy that I chose to deliver our first two children, the senior registrar in the British system, is the most experienced guy in the hospital, and he was very good, and he was a Christian, would have nothing to do with abortion. He never got the academic position he should have had. Never excluded because of that, but that was the real reason he never got the job. It didn't bother. And in fact, nothing happened until many years later I asked the question which I should have asked day one. I had felt that it was a woman's question. And one day I sat down and said, can I think that? And found to my horror, I couldn't. And of course, that's the church's problem, isn't it? You listen after the service tomorrow morning, and even during the service, just keep an account. How many times is the word feel used when the word think ought to be used? That's our problem in one sentence. We have substituted feeling for thought. There is nothing in the New Testament that makes you responsible for your feelings, because you aren't. What you are responsible for is what you do with your feelings, but that's an act of cognition, not an act of feeling. You are to work out your own salvation with fear and trembling, but the action is the action of the mind, not the action of the feelings. It's not pop psychology that we're dealing with. That's what I had to deal with. So there you have one half of the program, that how you could get sucked into doing abortions. If life has no meaning, if it is a woman's choice, then, of course, abortion is going to be the norm. And there are a lot of people who occupy that position. That is the way they function. And we are a pluralistic democracy. What are we going to do? We'll come to that at the end. If we made abortion illegal, there would be backstreet abortions. Anybody who has seen a backstreet abortion never wants to see another. Taking the very good lecture we had first, that is disproportionate punishment. It is horrendous. Now, the figures are always grossly inflated, which I ought to have realized. Again, we are so good at not applying our mind when it might make us uncomfortable. I did almost all the subspecialties in medicine because I qualified too young, and in Britain they don't think you're fit to have a responsible position until you get to 30. So I did a bit of pretty well everything, including quite a lot of nephrology. Now, one of the most common ways to die from a backstreet abortion is acute renal failure. And yet in 4 years of a nephrology unit, I never cared for a woman dying of acute renal failure from a septic abortion. They did happen, but I never personally cared for one. They could therefore be nowhere near the numbers they said, because we couldn't have coped if they were. They were inflated by at least one order of magnitude, if not two. But no investigative journalist ever pursued the data. As Nathanson says in his book, we just made the numbers up. Just like the coat hanger, which was never used, or if it was, it would have been lethal. A beautiful symbol for their purposes, but not the way it was done. Now, even when I was in doing my residency, they used to do abortions in the OR at night when everybody else had gone on the nurses. They got pregnant. It was commonplace. That's the world. So we ought to be careful about whether we wish to have the criminal law deal with abortion. I don't think that's the way to go. But we can talk more about that in a moment. But now let's look at the other side of the equation that has not been analyzed. Are there any consequences to abortion legislation that are purely logical and unavoidable that we need to think about? Well, the answer, of course, is yes, there are. The first one was very straightforward. shortly after abortion began to legalize, feminists came and to talk to the women who had abortions that they'd persuaded to have an abortion, saying it was just a bunch of cells and rather less than having a tooth extracted. And the women said, but it doesn't feel like that to me. It feels to me as though I've killed my baby. Now, there's a real problem here. I will say to the audience, here's the problem for you. Raise your hand if you can defend the doing of gratuitous harm to an innocent human being. How many people do you think raise their hand? None. No one ever has. No one has solved that problem. You can't defend that. It is, as Jay Budziszewski said, something that we can't not know. Everybody at a gut level, hardwired, I presume by God, knows that you ought not to do that. But that makes us incoherent, because if you're not innocent in utero, you never will be. It has the unique DNA that is its own, neither its mother's nor its father's, and that happened at fertilization. And if it was left alone, for as long as you've been left alone, it would look something like you of the appropriate race and sex. So you're incoherent. Now, that problem was solved largely by some feminist philosophers. Annette Meyer will do as a good example. But they realized that any objective biological definition, they lose. So the important thing to do was pull apart two words that most of us still think are synonyms: human being and human person. And they did it by proposing, amongst others, developmental, psychological, and even political definitions of what a person is. For a bioethicist, a person is a very complex idea. For you and me, it's very simple. We're right, they're wrong. But they're wrong because they've got an agenda that they must, by some means or other, defend. So the commonest accepted definition of personhood by the bioethicists would be that you become a person when you are capable of relationship. Now think about that for a moment. And those of you sitting next to your husband, don't look at him and wonder when it's going to happen. It's not going to happen. No, obviously, these functional definitions are very, very dangerous. And they have consequences, don't they? As Peter Kreis said to me a few months ago, you have to be careful about being lucid, because the next point I go to, of course, if the baby you are delivered of turns out to be developmentally 2 years old for the next 20 years, is that going to be more or less of a burden than a 9-month pregnancy? That's a no-brainer, isn't it? 2-year-olds are fun, but not if they stay there. 20 years of 2-year-old care is very, very hard work. Permanent 2-year-old care is a real burden. So, if you accept capable of relationship as a definition, there's an easy way out, isn't there? It's called infanticide. It's already happening. This domino has fallen. Just a year or two ago, the Dutch published in no less than the New England Journal of Medicine the Groningen Protocol for killing babies who were in no imminent danger of death, but were judged by that protocol to have a life not worth living. That one's happened, and it will continue. We are currently targeting approximately 200 genetic disorders for in utero abortion. Shortly, they will be just, it'll be occur to them that it's actually easier to do infanticide. Safer for the woman, too. And there'll be no reason not to do it. That's the next step. Of course, geriatricide for Alzheimer's fits in the same category. So does herpes encephalitis or something like that. So that's the first domino to fall down in my sequence, that if you accept, well, it's the second. The first one is the pulling apart of human being and human person. The second is a natural and logical consequence into infanticide, geriatricide, and the killing of the disabled. Now, this has other consequences built into it which people don't think about. We are a human rights-based society without any really serious talk about what human rights are. It's a very new idea, and it's not a Christian one, despite the last Pope's espousal of the idea. There wasn't a word for human rights as we know it in the Oxford Dictionary until the 20th century. The Japanese didn't even have the concept, let alone anything in the dictionary, till the end of the 19th century. The Christian word is responsibility, of course, not rights. And positive and negative rights are not the same thing. The rights to liberty and life are one thing. The right not to be interfered with, the negative rights, are extremely dangerous and difficult things, and it's highly dubious whether we should allow such things to take a major role in our justice system. You can tell the difference between the real ones and the bad ones fairly simply as a physician, certainly the ones that impinge on medicine. You only have to ask yourself the question, the right you are proposing, what is the reciprocal duty? You have no right to demand that your physician kill you, because I have no duty to do it. Whereas you have a duty for your physician to care for you, because I recognize that duty. It is clearly real. It's that reciprocation of the two that will distinguish the pseudo from the real. But we have now got to a point where rights have to be earned rather than being intrinsic. That's a very subtle but very important distinction. Children born after abortion was legalized are very different from me. I came into the world, I suspect, as the arrogant brat that I remained for most of my life, still am in many ways. God made me that way, it's my excuse, but it's not really a very good excuse, I recognize. But children used to come into the world, they're hardwired, aren't they, to expect fidelity from you. They have no power, but they can get you out of bed, they can get you to drive to emergency in the middle of the night, you name it, they can do it. God made them that way. That, by the way, is what's so wrong about divorce. Because divorce is an attack on that central, hardwired expectation of fidelity. And you can say to any student group anywhere in the Western world now, I know you all hate divorce, and nobody will argue with you. Because there's never been a child who enjoyed the divorce of its parents. The only thing the parents can do when they've been divorced because they got married without counseling and made wrong choices is to go to their children and say, I'm sorry, please forgive me. Don't ask them to rationalize it and say that it was good. It wasn't. The only way out, as we heard earlier, is through repentance, reconciliation, justification, grace, all those things. So we, without thinking, when we legalized abortion, we took intrinsic human rights and made them extrinsic. They were granted by the courts. Now that has an even worse implication for us. The next domino to go down, you can put them in different orders, they start going into branches of dominoes going out at this point, but we'll deal with next is justice. Because I'm going to run out of time, I can see.
Another half hour.
Okay. Okay. Well, justice is the next one. Now, one of the things you also need to do, as well as learn to ask questions, not make statements, is to collect atheists who are honest. Because that takes the anti-Christian rhetoric out of the discussion. And on this issue, much to my great delight a few years ago, I discovered that, as far as I can tell, an unbelieving Jewish professor at Yale had made the cleanest description of this problem. He taught common law at Yale in the 1970s, and just 6 years after the Roe v. Wade decision, he gave an absolutely magnificent lecture at Duke, which the liberals hate so much that they've even managed to make it hard to Google. And that's got to have been done by somebody. Normally you can put in a title and an author goes straight to it. You can't with this one. You have to go to the Duke University website to get there. But it's the Duke Law Review, 1979, if you want to go and find it. It's worth having copied to give to people. And his name is Arthur Leff. And it's so good that the opening paragraph I know by heart. Because it poses the problem of the modern world in one paragraph. And he goes like this. He says, I want to believe, and so do you, in a complete immanent and transcendent set of propositions about right and wrong, findable rules that direct us as to how to live our lives righteously. Now the word immanent, I probably don't have to teach Lutherans this, but I don't know whether you're all Lutherans, is not the same word as imminent. Imminent is round the corner. Immanent means available to you. So what were those transcendent and immanent rules that an unbelieving Jew was thinking about? Come on, you're Lutherans, you know. Say it in public. If you get it wrong, it's 100% learning experience, so you should say it. What's he thinking about?
Natural law?
No, then the Jews don't think about natural law. What do they think about? God's law, the Torah, given, transcendent from God, understandable by us. Why does he want it? Because if it's true that that's the way it came, then both the judge and the judged are under the authority of God. Then justice is a possibility, isn't it?
Yes.
But, goes on Leff, he says, but I also want to believe, and so do you, in no such thing, but rather that we are wholly free to decide for ourselves what we ought to do and what we ought to be. What we want, heaven help us, is to be simultaneously perfectly ruled and perfectly free. That is, at the same time, to discover the right and the good and to invent it. And not even Americans can do that. If you have the one, you don't have the other. Which is it going to be? Because it will change society. One judge in the Roe v. Wade decision recognized what was at stake. He actually wrote in his dissent, "This decision is not an act of justice, but an act of raw judicial power." Now, Leff does something very unacademic. Following that opening paragraph, he writes 20 pages of lucid prose. You can understand every word. You don't need a dictionary much. You can follow his argument, and he weighs these two positions. But he's a professor at Yale in the 1970s. Social Darwinianism is the norm. He comes down on Darwin's side. And by the way, the argument against Darwin is not biological. It's metaphysical. Altruism is number one, two, three, and four as the argument against Darwin. The best person, again, fortunately, is an atheist philosopher. Australia's best, a man called David Stove. If you want a good Christmas read, which will give you a chuckle and also educate you, Darwinian Fairy Tales by David Stove is absolutely superb. But this is what's at stake here. So Leff, when he gets to his penultimate paragraph, comes down and he knows it on the wrong side of the argument. He says, "It looks to me as though we are all that we have." In other words, Darwin is right. It's just a colossal accident and we have to take charge. But he's honest still. He's still Jewish. That's their great strength, their rationality. He says, "But looking around the world, this is an extraordinarily unappetizing prospect. If brotherly love exists, the ruling model appears to be Cain and Abel. Only if the law was unspeakable by us and unnatural would it be unchallengeable. As things stand now, everything's up for grabs." He doesn't even manage to write the next sentence, which he should have written. "The law has now become not the pursuit of justice, but the pursuit of power as a result of the Roe v. Wade decision." That's the trashing of a long and noble history that goes back to the Middle Ages. That's the disaster. It's far bigger than pro-life groups recognize, and far, far more important. Now, he can't live with his own conclusion. Wonderful man that he must have been. I'd love to have had a conversation with him. He writes two more sentences, which are a total non sequitur. He says, "Nevertheless, napalming babies is wicked. Buying and selling each other is depraved. Starving the poor is wrong. There is in this world such a thing as evil." He just said there wasn't. There was only a Darwinian accident. But there is metaphysical reality out there. Because his last two sentences were right, he knew what he ought to do. He was well trained. If you have a technically correct argument and you arrive at an unsustainable conclusion, you must re-examine the premise. Because those last two sentences are true and there's not a person on earth who doesn't know it, then the last paragraph must begin, "Because we all know that napalming babies is wicked, buying and selling each other is depraved, starving the poor is wrong, it looks to me as though we cannot be all that we have." There must be a God. There has to be. But he couldn't do it. He went back to Yale and never again in his life, attempted a lecture on the philosophy of justice. And of course, our law schools have no lectures on the philosophy of justice that are anywhere near as serious as Leff, if there are indeed any at all, because they lead to a conclusion they do not want. And in our universities, at least three faculties now teach quite straightforwardly that the law is not about justice, it's about power. That's women's studies, sadly, black studies, and homosexual studies, which is why all three do not wish to have public debate. They wish to use the courts, which they have very carefully loaded with their own people, to push through their own agenda. Meanwhile, we sat on our hands and went to sleep, too lazy to train our children to be the judges and the lawyers and the professors they ought to be. We are paying the price for our own laziness. And I think of the sermons I heard in a working class church in the 1950s, where Josephus would be quoted by men who had had an education that ceased at the age of 12. I don't hear anything that comes close in the modern church. And only a few churches, including yours, have a few remaining shreds of liturgy which might redeem us. Most evangelical churches don't even have any repentance on Sunday morning, which means there's no entry into the presence of God. It's the only entry ticket, isn't it? So that's the next domino to go down. Justice is dead because of it. And if we wish to get back to objective moral truth, we're going to have to deal with this. Now, that move from intrinsic to extrinsic rights has another line of dominoes that go down. Because, of course, everybody born after abortion was legalized, your child, for instance, in a few months' time, weeks' time, she is technically your choice, or he is technically your choice, right? You could have destroyed it before birth. So children born after the legalization of abortion are born on purpose, as a choice, not as the gift of God, at one level at least. And they're born with something in mind, aren't they? It's not an accident that all these books on how to improve your self-image flooded into existence as abortion became legalized. As I said, little brats like me came into the world with a sense deep down that we had a right to be here. There's nobody in Canada born today who has a right to be here. They're there by choice. That changes their self-image. Not surprising that we're in trouble, is it? As we lose the imago Dei, of course, modern students have a great deal of difficulty in defending their own existence against that of, shall we say, a peregrine falcon. Even the animal rights movement is actually a result of the abortion decision. Scratch an animal rights person, particularly a woman, and you will often find somebody in denial of their own abortion. One of our ways of dealing with these objective moral truths is to put an inordinate amount of energy into something that is diverting the moral logic of the universe. That's what happens. Some of the things they do are really quite bizarre. Like one woman who Jay Bajuszewski describes, who had an abortion because her husband was unfaithful just as she got pregnant with a child they both wanted. She had the abortion to punish him. Then afterwards, she had a second abortion to punish herself for having the first. He can get that knotted. We're in trouble when we go this way. The animal rights movement is an interesting one. And it provided me about a year ago with an interesting recurrent reminder that I have from the good Lord that he's in charge of these things, not me. I just have to pay attention. I was in Harvard, and I thought, will I make this point or not? And then into my head popped a marvelous way to do it in Harvard. I suddenly realized that one of Harvard's sons, favorite sons, had seen this coming before abortion was legalized and wrote a poem about it. None other than Robert Frost, who's certainly not on our side of this discussion. But like many poets, they're more honest than they realize. Now, Robert Frost, like I, live on a farm. And every farm on the northern part of this continent has hornets every year, and they're interesting creatures. And he and I both go and watch them. This particular year, he got stung by going too close. But he still went back and watched. And one day he was watching the hornet, and it attacked a nail in the wall. And he was surprised. It took three goes to realize it wasn't food. And then he realized he'd been guilty of anthropomorphizing the insect, thinking he could think where actually it was just a bunch of reflexes. And then he wrote The White-Tailed Hornet. And the lines that came into my head, just like that, which is a lovely thing to happen, were these. Robert Frost wrote after this experience, "Won't this instinct matter bear revision? Won't almost any theory bear revision? To err is human, not to animal. Or so we pay the compliment to instinct that really takes away instead of gives. Our humour, conscientiousness and worship went long since to the dogs under the table and served us right for having instituted downward comparisons. As long on earth as our comparisons were stoutly upwards, with gods and angels we were men at least. But once our comparisons were yielded downward into the must and even into the mud and even dust, 'twas disillusion upon disillusion. We were lost piecemeal to the animals, like people thrown out to delay the wolves. Only our fallibility was left us, and this day's work makes even that seem doubtful." Isn't it interesting? The animal rights movement and abortion, in my view, absolutely connected. Because when you lose the image of God, you lose a lot. Now, it gets worse. The last clinic I ran was before I retired from pediatrics, was for severely disabled children. A particular group, quadriplegic children who will never walk, talk, or feed themselves. There isn't time to explain why, but that clinic was the last clinic I ran. And one of the reasons I was interested is that children with a high quadriplegia, say from cerebral palsy, will become necessarily malnourished because, amazingly, no one had ever measured or attempted to measure the efficiency of their feeding apparatus. I'm quantitative. I was asked to see one of these children who, from my point of view, was technically malnourished. And then I wondered why, and I realized it must be something to do with this. And we fabricated a tool for measuring it. It turns out these children have 10% of normal efficiency. Now, you need to feed for about an hour a day to get your nutrient intake. If you have a 10% efficient machine, you need 10 hours a day. No child can be fed for 10 hours a day, and nobody has the patience to do it, and no state will pay for it. So necessarily, these children must become malnourished. Once I'd got that worked out, I went to the obvious place. I started driving around outside Ottawa to visit all the homes where long-stay quadriplegic CPs were kept, and in a few weeks, I found 20 teenagers weighing less than 40 pounds. It was not neglect. They were doing everything they possibly could. And to cut a long story short, we put the first permanent feeding tubes into these children, little buttons. And it took most mothers a couple of years to realize they couldn't even feed this baby. To get a baby like that, at least I can feed it. But I had to tell them, no, you can't. It's not your fault. It took them 2 years to get there. But two things happened in that clinic that relate to the abortion discussion. One was, occasionally I would have a mother come in. There were other children as well as these quadriplegic children there. One day a woman came in, obviously upset. I said, "What's the matter?" She said, "A woman on the bus looked at my baby and said, 'Why didn't you have that child aborted?'" See, if you have had an abortion for totally trivial reasons, and you meet another woman who's dedicating her life to a non-trivial problem, are you going to feel good about it or bad about it? That's why she said, "Why didn't you have aborted?" And that's why our society is going to put pressure on us to have abortions. Because particularly the rich elite who rule us are almost all infected with this disease. They're not going to be charitable about it. They can't, because their own souls are at stake. So the next casualty, of course, is the common good and compassion. The theology of the cross can lead to compassion. The theology of utilitarianism, the atheology of utilitarianism, cannot. Now, of course, God puts these people in the world for good reason. He knows what he's doing. He is a utilitarian because he sees the end from the beginning and the objective is always good. One woman was actually got to the point where she put this, that allowed the button to be put in within 6 months, which is very fast. Now, initially, we put them in straight away now, but at those stages, we got the surgeons to put a soft tube in first, we put the button in our patients. So I had this child who's ready for the button to be put in. And I said to her, look, he's going to cry. I have to stretch this bit of polythene out on this metal thing and pop it through the hole. And there's no way I can stop that hurting, but it'll be very quick. Do you want to go outside the clinic while I do it? And she said, no, I understand what you're going to do, and I can hold his hand and I won't interfere. I trusted her, so I did it. And he cried and she comforted him. And I said to her, do you mind explaining to me how you've got this far this quickly? Because you're way ahead of the curve. And she looked at me as though I needed remedial training, which I did. And she said, well, she came from a poorer part of town, and she said, I'd had a family, and they'd all grown up and left home, and I was very lonely. So God gave me a baby who will never grow up. And then she explained how this baby was civilizing the whole neighborhood. I can hardly tell this story without emotion, but there were lots of latchkey kids, of course, parents obsessed with money in a poor part of town, both of them working, kids come home from school, let themselves in and watch god-awful television. But now there's a little guy on the block who's fed with a syringe or a little button on his belly. That's cool. They all want to have a go. So they all come to visit. And his mother teaches them to be gentle, to take their turn. And there are nicer words than the ones you're using, so she improves their vocabulary as well. That's not a bad contribution to a community, is it? If I had my way with young offenders, I wouldn't send them to incarceration. I would make them work with the disabled. That would change them. We are losing all these things and others, but this is the domino effect of Roe v. Wade. And we have to learn to make this case winsomely, logically, carefully, without anger. All I have to say at the end of this lecture in a secular setting is I have laid out for you in the last 40, 45 minutes or so two worlds. Which one do you want to hand on to your children? And what's happened now is what always happens. And it's our fault. When the world goes bad, Jesus said, it's our fault. You, in this room, are the salt of the earth. Salt in the ancient world was not for flavor. It was for preservation of what is good and for the destruction of what is evil. And it wasn't pure sodium chloride, it was rock salt. So there was good salt and bad salt. So the housewife went to the market to buy her salt and tasted the top of the bag to find out whether it was, and the businessman made sure that it was. But what if that sack had stood in the water for a little while and then dried out? It would look the same in terms of volume, but the wet part would have had the sodium chloride leached out. So shortly, her meat and fish would begin to smell rather badly. Did she blame the meat and the fish or the salt? She blamed the salt. See, what Jesus is saying to us is, when you look at 100,000 abortions a year in Canada, that's the meat and the fish rotting because the salt is not salty. Sorry to have ruined your lunch. I don't know if there are any questions.
I guess the next, my mind, because I teach in this area,
yeah.
And find students always say to me, why didn't somebody tell me about this? And they blame their parents for not telling them. And a lot of them are Christians.
Yes.
But the one I want to get is eugenics.
Yes.
For me, ultimately, when you look at what's happening in the States, yeah. Especially now with their election, the pushing of the eugenics agenda.
And here in the nice, quiet Canadian way, we're doing it as well. There are approximately 200 in prenatal diseases that are now targeted for eugenic abortion. And of course, if you're a utilitarian, why wouldn't you do that? Two or three years ago, I was on the same program as Francis Collins in Chicago. Francis Collins is the director of the Human Genome Project. He's an evangelical Christian. And so he was talking, in this case, to a Christian audience. It was the annual conference of the Christian Medical Dental Association of the U.S. And I was listening to him, and I knew what his major contribution was, and I don't suppose most people in the audience did. And I expected a major scientist giving a general review paper normally mentions is his own contribution. He never mentioned his. Because he was the co-discoverer of the gene for cystic fibrosis with Lepchi in Toronto. And so I was thinking while he was giving his lecture, why is he not talking about that? And then I realized. See, we don't do science for utilitarian reasons. We're driven by things we don't understand to get started. I was fascinated by the protein that kept me off the streets 25 years before I even knew the protein existed. Well, I knew it had to exist, but I didn't know where it was. And I wasn't interested in other proteins. That's the way it goes. He was interested in this gene. Sometimes you can track down what it was, and I guess in genes it's usually because there's some connection socially or whatever, family, to what you're pursuing. You need motivation because there's long hours of use, of unrewarding work involved. So I presume that somewhere in his family history there's a CF problem. And what he wanted to do was to find the gene in the hope that it would help. Well, in this particular case, we've gone all the way. Got the gene, expressed it, we know exactly what the problem is. It's a very small change in the chloride conductance channel of a little gate, a zinc gate, that doesn't work properly. We can do absolutely nothing about it. But whenever we get a gene, within weeks, if we wish, we have a test for in utero diagnosis. So the only thing that Francis Collins has contributed to CF, apart from knowledge, is that the prevalence of CF has dropped by 20% in many parts of North America now. That's eugenic abortion. So afterwards, I didn't ask him in public, I didn't want to embarrass him, but there was a moment, he had to rush off, but we did have a moment to get there. I said, what do you think about eugenic abortion? And he said, John, I don't know what to say. He's the director of the Human Genome Project who is struggling with what to say about eugenic abortion. He's in a very difficult position. He's a good man, pray for him. He obviously never forgot that conversation because shortly after, a year or so later, I had reason to call him about something, send him an email, wondering whether he would have find time to respond to me, and he came back in 20 minutes. So he hadn't forgotten that conversation. But you're right, it's a huge issue. I talk about it to students as what I call the tyranny of the measurable. You see, somebody is going to be asked to judge the value of an in utero genome quite shortly. Ultimately, it will be computerized, but I mean, that's only putting distance between us. It's still the programmer who's made the decisions, or somebody else has told the programmer what they want. And so I say to students, imagine you're on the committee looking at in utero genomes, which shortly will be required if you're going to have healthcare. And let's imagine, for the sake of illustration, that on the same day you have Mike Tyson and Helen Keller in utero. And let's imagine that Helen Keller was blind and deaf for genetic reasons, which it could have been. Which one passes? Helen Keller literally will go down the drain. Mike Tyson gets an A+. But who contributed to American, and indeed world culture? If you've never read Walker Percy's little essay in Message in a Bottle on the miracle in Alabama of what happened to Helen Keller, read it, it's beautiful. Can move you to tears, and you can move other people to tears using it. But that's it. That's the tyranny of the measurable. And the immeasurables, which are essential to our lives, that philosophers no longer talk about to their students, are what we need more of. And the church no longer talks about. Yes?
Yeah, I don't know if you're aware of the debate that happened I think it was the late 70s, between Dr. Gordon Stein, who was a leading atheist at the time, and Dr. Greg Bonson. Does God exist? But Dr. Bonson showed very clearly what you stated in your essay, that unbelievers have this innate problem that they want to have both. They want to have both the justice. They think that everything is wrong.
Yes.
But they want to be their own God.
Yes.
And you can't have both.
That's right.
And he showed that very, very clearly in that
I had a lovely example of that. Just last week, I had the great pleasure of meeting Michael Heller, who was the winner of the Templeton Prize last year, a Roman Catholic priest and a cosmologist from Poland, an absolutely delightful man. And if you want to see the talk he gave at our college, it will be on our website in a little while, which is augustinecollege.org. But he had a debate with Dawkins on the BBC, and he said that Dawkins, of course, being the ultimate reductionist, and also sophomoric in terms of his philosophy with it, and very angry. But Michael Heller is a delightful man. And at the end he said, Richard, I think you and I have much more in common and much less separating us than you realize. It's really only a spelling problem. You spell rationality with a small r, and I spell it with a capital R. It's the same thought, beautifully expressed.
I have three questions, sir.
Three.
What did Hippocrates know that we have forgotten?
That's this afternoon's lecture.
Oh, okay. Okay, I'll get that.
Well, the problem is
that my second question was, in your talks, have you talked about, like, there's so much research and studies now, so many talking about the pain abortion is bringing to women physically,
oh, yes.
mentally.
Mm-hmm. Sure. There's a lot there, yes.
And, I think that's very important. And the other thing is, what do you think about a strategy of having women who've had abortions sue abortion doctors for damage and for not getting fully informed consent as a medical doctor?
Since this is being recorded, I better repeat your questions and we'll take them one by one. The question of the consequences of abortion, they are becoming clearer. Obviously, the pain of women, fortunately David Ferguson in New Zealand is a psychiatrist and a pro-choice person, a year or two ago published a paper saying, look, it's time to quit the nonsense. My clinic is full of women who are suffering from the abortion they had. Yeah, of course, he's taken a lot of flak for publishing it, but he's right. Another area is cerebral palsy. There's clear evidence now that cerebral palsy is very much related to premature birth, which is very much related to previous abortions. This is showing up most strongly in the previous Iron Curtain countries, where abortion rates were roughly 7 abortions for every live birth. That means that there's an awful lot of premature births. And Hungary actually has worked hard on this and has reduced their abortion rate, and they've got the figures now. Their prematurity rates are dropping while ours are rising. So there's no question about that. The other thing that's happened in the last year or two, there are now at least 3 papers, I have the data from one of them in front of me, that have looked at this unknowingly, which is wonderful. The Scandinavians are very good at doing wonderful unknowing research every now and again. In this case, they study pregnancy, and what they were concerned with is what are the needs for care in the year after you have your baby. But of course, if you do a prospective study of pregnant women in the Western world, you necessarily end up with abortion debate data as well, which they didn't intend to collect, but they were honest, they collected it. What they found was stunning. Now, I think I can explain this. You'll have to pay careful attention for a moment. The way they analyze it is what's called a risk ratio. So you set the one with the least problems at 1 and compare the other group as a ratio. So you have 3 times or 2 times or 4 times as much. And the things they looked at in the year following the end of the pregnancy with either a baby or an abortion was total mortality, natural death, accidents, suicide, and the risk of being murdered. Homicide. Now, it turns out that, of course, in every category, the woman who has the baby has the lower risk. So she's set at 1. Relatively speaking, a woman who comes into a clinic and demands an abortion is 350% more likely to die in the next year than the woman who has the baby. That's a risk ratio of 3.5. Natural death is only up by a little bit, 0.6. Accidents are up 4.24, 400%. Suicide is up 600%. And the risk of being murdered is up 1,399% in that particular study, which is in Acta Scandinavica. That's an amazing set of data. Now, don't argue that abortion causes that outcome. That's fallacious. But what you can argue and what you should argue is that given the risks that a woman who has an abortion is correlated with, what she does when she enters your clinic is telling you, I am a woman in deep trouble. And here are the deep troubles I am facing in the next year. So whatever else happens to an abortionist when he does an abortion is he knows, now he has no reason for not knowing, that he has before him a woman facing huge risks in the next year. Not because of the abortion, but because of everything that leads up to it. It's much deeper than that. There is a duty of care of almost astronomical proportions. But they run no follow-up clinics. Neither do they even keep their names and addresses. And they make no provision for the care of these women. That's what we should upbraid them about. That is a dereliction of duty. And that, of course, would be another reason for pursuing the case that you're supposing, that why don't women sue? Well, they don't want to sue because they don't want to remember it. There's an even more striking example of that. I have been asking for 20 years. I don't teach in the university anymore at the moment, but until I retired, every year in my own course, I asked fourth-year honors students every year as a routine question, can you name for me the two sexually transmitted diseases for which a condom is essentially irrelevant? Never, ever got a correct answer. And, of course, they are herpes and human papillomavirus. And the point about human papillomavirus is that it causes 95% plus of cervical cancer in women. So good pedagogy should demand that at the beginning of a class on sex education, you should hold up a condom and say, this is all we have to prevent the transmission of sexually transmitted disease, except chastity before and fidelity afterwards, which will protect you completely. They ought to say that, if you can do it. But this is all we have. And it's utterly irrelevant for these two diseases because they're transmitted by skin-to-skin contact. One is the cause of cancer, and the other is a risk to any baby you subsequently have. Do you think that would make a difference? And the fact that you can prove that the educators have never made this an important point in their lecture is certainly dereliction of duty. So all those women with cervical cancer have a very good open and shut class action case for suing the education department and the sex educators. I think even better than abortion. But there's lots of class action suits for these things that are possible. Do you want me to stop at this point? Is it, or you can carry on? Are there any more questions? Oh, sorry, I can't. You're in the darkness, as philosophers sometimes are.
I thought I heard you use the term post and darkenment.
That's right. I prefer the term.
Explain.
It's not mine, of course, it's Alistair McIntyre's. The Enlightenment was not an enlightenment, it was an endarkenment. In the sense that before that happened, before Occam and Descartes and Bacon got to work on us, we knew that qualities mattered. Afterwards, we had changed the meaning of the word fact from including moral reality and metaphysical reality to purely physical reality. We went from, if you like, a four-cause universe to a two-cause universe. It was very powerful for science, but it was a disaster for life. And Dawkins is the end product of that. And David Stove describes that sort of thing very clearly. And this is Alistair McIntyre's point. I mean, Alistair McIntyre considered to have made the point more clearly than anyone else that we need to face. In my view, he's my favorite philosopher in the world at the moment because lucid is perhaps not the word to use. He's a little difficult to read because he seems not to believe in commas and write long sentences. But he has got the issues straight. And he, for instance, has done a wonderful article called How Virtues Became Vices. And he points out that a bioethicist can never tell you what you ought to do until you tell him what you believe. It's basically the talk I've given, in a sense. He says, if you believe that abortion is a matter of a woman's choice, then there is no way that abortion can be wrong. But if, on the other hand, you believe that the sanctity of life is the most important of the virtues, then there's no way that it can be right. And there is no possibility of fudging the issue, as Canadians would like, to get a consensus on this. It's not possible. There is no consensus. And our human rights folk are the worst, you see. They pick and choose the virtues that lead to the ends that they have already politically decided that they want. Whereas the virtues, of course, are laid out and they have a natural structure to them and they are hierarchical. As Robert Spitzer puts it, as the idea of person goes, so goes the culture. In a rights-orientated culture, if you have no right to life, then technically you have no rights at all, because you have to be alive to be a rights bearer. And if the judges can take your right to be alive away, they take all your rights away. So we need to go back to what is the fundamental structure of the cosmos. What are the starting positions for our social settings, and work from that. And McIntyre, in his book After Virtue, does an incredible review of Western history. And then he, at the end, he has a marvelous peroration. And he says, paraphrasing a little freely, but not that much, and you can go and check it out for yourself in After Virtue, he says, if you have followed my argument, then you should realize that what I have been arguing is that we have already entered upon a second Dark Ages. But we should not be entirely without hope. Because the last time this happened, good men and women withdrew from the shoring up of the Roman Imperium into the task of forming communities within which they could keep the civilities and the virtues alive. And they succeeded. The only difference is that last time the barbarians were waiting at the gate. But this time they have been ruling us for quite some time. And it is our failure to appreciate that fact that is at the heart of our problem. We are waiting for a doubtless new St. Benedict, because it was the monasteries that saved us last time. We don't know what it's going to be this time. But I suspect we already see the beginnings of it in the desertion of the public education system by Christians, especially for primary education. I have 17 grandchildren. None of my grandchildren are in the public education system, because it is being used for propaganda and social engineering. And I will go bankrupt rather than let that happen. When they are formed, they can go and take on the system, and they will. That's also why we run Augustine College, because about 11 years ago, six of us in the University of Ottawa were brought together by Providence. And we founded this course. Well, 15 years ago, we brought together. We first needed 4 years of reading together. And we read everything we could find on education, from literally from the Greeks to Alistair MacIntyre, through Augustine, Aquinas, and the rest. And we realized that the problem, you send your young people to university today, hopefully not at Concordia, but in most other places, certainly, and they have about an 80% probability of losing their faith in any real sense. And going to Bible school first will not solve that problem, because the university doesn't allow the Bible as a starting text. You can, by the way, now quote the Bible in the university, as long as you're subtle. I do it all the while, but I always paraphrase. That means they can't Google what I'm saying. And since they're biblically illiterate, they don't know where it came from. And I don't tell them, so they have to take the thought at face value. You've got to learn that art. And by the way, St. John the Divine was one of the greatest paraphrasers. There are more references to other parts of Scripture in Revelation than any other book in the Bible, but they're almost all inaccurate. God doesn't mind. So we started realizing that the solution was to teach the history of ideas. And so we run an 8-month program in which we teach the history of science, medicine and mathematics, art and architecture, literature and philosophy, the history of the church, history of music and Latin, to make you a bit more logical. And the good news is, it works. Our graduates, we've now had 11 years of this, those that have gone through university, at least 90% of them have come out with a flourishing faith. They've taken the university on rather than been destroyed by the university. And the good news is that it is the liberal elite who are more aware of the need for this than, say, professors in Christian schools, who in many cases suffer from what I call physics envy. And they can sometimes be more liberal than those in the mainline universities, because they think that it's a comfortable position to be in, whereas those in the mainline universities are beginning to be very uncomfortable. So amazingly, I have some very, very wonderful opportunities. Just to give one illustration, a couple of months ago I did grand rounds in the University of Chicago. And that in itself was amazing. I did the talk that I'm going to do this afternoon, What Hippocrates Knew We've Forgotten. It was a God thing that made it happen. It shouldn't have happened, but it did, and it went down extremely well, because it's a very liberal school, although it was founded by Baptists. But the Jews there are also aware that the world is in trouble. And they asked me, they look after you very well when you do that, and they said, the 2 or 3 days you're going to spend with us, is there anybody in the University of Chicago that you really like to meet? And I said, yes, there is. I would love to meet Robert Fogel. And they said, we can arrange that. So I had a wonderful afternoon with Robert Fogel. Robert Fogel is a New York Jew of the Red Diaper Brigade, originally, a secular Jew, who won the first Nobel Prize for econometrics some many years ago now. He's aged 80. The reason I wanted to see him was that in 2000 he published a book called The Fourth Great Awakening. And in that book, I never thought I'd read a book by a secular Jew that wrote very appreciatively of the impact of the 18th century revival and even of Finney on American culture. And here's an economist who was interested in measurement arguing that the future of America does not depend upon science or upon skill, but upon the formation of virtue. Who can deny that with the subprime disaster, which was basically a failure of ethics? And let me just read to you as a final thing almost, Fogel's list of what is necessary if the Western world is going to survive. The reason he got this list, he told me, the reason he wrote the book, which is why I wanted to find out where it was, I said, what did your colleagues think about this book? And he said, by and large, they failed to engage. Why did you write it? He said, well, I married a black Episcopalian lady who died a few years ago. I haven't got over it yet, but I realized she had made my children what they are and not me. And this is what she had given them. 15 virtues. In order of importance, a sense of purpose, teleology, the thing that Descartes and Bacon and Occam destroyed, a sense of opportunity, an eschatological future, if you like, that the world is in God's hands, it's not hopeless, a sense of where the world is going at the moment to make the right choices. It's good to pray about your which experiments you do. I always did. A strong family ethic, a sense of community, a capacity to engage in rational discussion with diverse groups, an ethic of benevolence, a work ethic, a sense of discipline, a capacity to focus and concentrate one's efforts. You know, when I was the age of my students, I thought nothing of reading for 5 hours without any iPod or any other nonsense going on in the background. They can't do that today. We are not getting the students we used to have, and it's foolish to pretend we are. A capacity to resist the lure of pleasure, a capacity for self-education, a thirst for knowledge, an appreciation of quality, and a little bit of self-esteem. Now, the church knows about all that. It's not exactly our list, is it? It doesn't have the theological virtues up front. He's on his way. He'll get there, I'm sure. Yes?
You mentioned you have a website.
Yes, I do. It's just my name, johnpatrick.ca. It's got some free material there that you can download, including if you're up to the MP3 level, which I'm not, but there is a downloadable MP3 file for free called The Four Levels of Happiness, which is the most powerful pre-evangelism tool I know. Using it, I can even get New York Jewish physicians to beg for the gospel in Grand Rounds. It's fun to do. I have a few CDs and things with me if people are really interested. In particular, if any of you are really interested in music, we had Jeremy Begbie come to the college 2 or 3 years back, and I have about 4 of them left. That's all with me at the moment. But he gave a wonderful lecture on the sound of hope, helping you to understand why your church has music wars. They all do, don't they? And he begins the DVD by, this is irrelevant to the lecture, but you asked the question, I'm using it. He plays a little bit of Mozart. He's a concert class pianist who teaches theology through the arts in Edinburgh and Cambridge, now in North Carolina as well. And he stops one chord before the end of the piece. And he says, now, if Mozart was 2 floors up and asleep, he would wake up, come all the way down to play that last chord because he couldn't sleep until he was. And you can all hear that the music was not complete until that was done. And he says, you ought to be able to see what's at stake here. Music in the Western tradition is a home, away, home again pattern. You don't have to be brilliant to see the theological implications. Eden, the world, heaven, Israel, Egypt, Israel. It's not circular, it's linear. That's direction. Now, what postmodernity did, it'll die. I mean, it's just the fag end of modernity, but it's done a lot of damage in the process, was to take some of this stuff away. And it didn't begin with French philosophers in the 1950s, according to Jeremy. It began with Chopin in the 1890s or wherever it was. Chopin actually was the first to ask the question, why resolve? So he wrote a few mazurkas that had no ending. They just stopped in the middle, so to speak. The French, of course, picked it up in Debussy and others. And it reached its zenith, really, with Schoenberg, who was a sensitive Jew in Vienna at the beginning of the 20th century. And he knew his world was going to fall apart, as poets always do. And so he wrote music that was fiendishly contrived to have no home key. That's why if you go to a concert with Schoenberg on the program, don't expect to enjoy the Schoenberg. He doesn't intend you to enjoy it because he is looking at a grim future. And you halve the ticket sales if you put it on the agenda, on the program. But all the young people listen to Schoenberg, but they don't know it. It's in film schools. Films like Mission Impossible are full of Schoenberg because it keeps you on the edge of your seat, which is exactly what they want. And he takes you through this process and makes you feel the pain of people like Webern and Schoenberg. And he makes you understand by looking at pop songs that our young people don't have silly sentimental songs like we had in the 50s and 60s. The rock music of today is full of angst, pain, real pain. And we decry it instead of saying we can help with that pain. And he shows you how to go about that. And shows you there's some modern musicians who are really doing very interesting things in this era. If you've got serious Christian musicians, it's a must-see DVD. The second one is entirely devoted to the Bach Chaconne. I have a few copies if you're really interested. It's a fundraiser for the college, so I'm not going to give them away. I'm not going to give the CDs away either because they're also a fundraiser for the college. We won't teach more than 20 students a year. There's no way you write a business plan for that. Our agreement with God, our covenant, if you like, we didn't want to do this, but homeschooling moms and dads and graduate students wanted us to do it. So when we started 11 years ago, we said, we'll do it, but if this college goes into the red, we're out of here. We thought, 1 year, we're done. Here we are 11 years later with various miracles en route. But we also have a duty to do what we can to make it happen. But thank you for listening.